Hey, what's up, friends? Welcome to Rescue Your Own Damn Self, the podcast, where each and every week we take an epic journey down our own magical yellow brick road with kick-ass guests sharing their silly stories, awesome analogies, fearless failures, tragic tumbles, empowering aha moments, courageous comebacks, and legendary or even laughable life lessons. I'm your host, Lori Mork, and I'm fired up and ready to show you that you were the fierce warrior, swinging the damn sword, slaying at life all along. It's time to rescue your own damn self. Jules is an award-winning author, speaker, and bodybuilder, and hopes to inspire others to push forward no matter what the challenges. After enduring an abusive childhood, Jules decided to use her earlier trauma to enter recovery, sexually liberate herself, and enter the competitive world of bodybuilding. At age 49, Jules placed third at the NPC North American Championships in 2021. Her book received the first place award winner for LGBTQ memoir and second place for autobiography in the Firebird Book Award contest. The Making of a Woman. The Making of a Woman is a compelling autobiography of a dynamic female who refused to bow down to the circumstances of her birth. With a prevailing sense of self and survival, Jules fought a hardscrabble war against the forces and people that populated her life in a way that often crushes others. Jules, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you.
I'm really excited. You and I started talking before I even hit record because we have one thing in common for sure, and that's the love for competitions and stage.
Yes.
What category did you compete in?
You know, initially I began in physique because I built a really nice back and I just had a lot of that extra muscle. And I also had bigger legs. But this last year, actually, I shifted down into figure. And that's really where I knocked it out of the park. So I am now figure. I don't think I'll ever go back to physique.
Well, and I mean, figure is where my heart and soul is, even though I do help a lot of bikini competitors. Figure is where I stood most of the time. The only thing that I got kind of jealous of, because it didn't exist when I was in it, is physique got to do a routine. And I was like, to be able to choose music and show more personality.
Yeah.
Was a little bit more exciting to me than like quarter turn, quarter turn, quarter turn. So that was the only reason I was like, oh, physique gets to do a routine. You know, you don't have to be a gymnast like in fitness, but figure is a great space to be.
And I think there's something about, for me, it found like it was my happy place because I could have that muscular exterior, yet the finesse and the heels and the little, that it just hit everything lined up for me right there. So I'm very comfortable in that class. I did very well in that class. So yeah, I think I'm going to be here for a little bit.
Oh, that's awesome. And was that your second show?
Nope. Let's see. So let me just give you a quick rundown. It was last year, really, was this huge turning point. Again, I did prep for physique. I was putting on all this muscle, had great conditioning, did a local show, and didn't really place as well. I mean, one of the coaches actually, or the judges, contacted my coach and said, you know, there's one show left this year. And I think if we put her in figure, she's going to do really well. And so I had like 12 days to stay in prep and go buy some dang heels and learn this. I mean, I'm doing like this coaching online, right? Like in prep mode, you know? So I was like, you know, can't walk in these damn shoes. But what happened is I took like third overall, I took second in one class and I took first in another, which brought me to nationals this year. Where I placed in the top three of my categories.
Yeah. So you found your home. You found your home.
I found my home. Finally. You know how devastating it is. You put all this endless effort and work and hours and training and eating. And you get up there and you're like, are you kidding me? That was not my best day. Or let me try it again. And that's what that one show felt like. It was kind of like, oh, I get a second chance.
Right.
And so I think that had some of the, you know, the energy that I brought to the stage that day too. So, yeah. Well,
let's back up. Let's go before that. First of all, you have a book that's out now.
Yes.
And we'll dive right into that. But it's called The Making of a Woman, which I think is a fabulous title. But let's go way back. What's your story, Jules? Where did all of this begin? And how did we get to the book releasing? Because there's always a story or multiple stories to get us there.
Isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth? You know, I was born and raised in the Midwest. My mom was, we were in the 70s. And so the reason I say that is for resources. Like we didn't have what we are at like today, iPhones and all this other stuff. I mean, we barely saw pamphlets on tables about, you know, dysfunction or trauma or depression. Or so, I mean, we're just going way back in time. And so it was just my mom and my dad, and I was very loved. I was a little family unit, and my mom was she was a 9-to-5er, and my dad tried to run his own business. But my father also was in the throes of the disease of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And so that's really, I think, where a lot of effort came in, and that loving and supportive. But every time he would try to do something, it would backfire. You know, it was always like ending up in a mess situation. And unfortunately, he got to the point in life where the best decision was to attempt a family suicide. Mm-hmm. And so experiencing that, I was like 6 years old. So I don't even think I necessarily processed it like an adult would. Like people are like astounded when they hear that. And I think, well, you know, my daddy just wasn't well and we just went away somewhere, you know? So I think I have like a child's perception of that. So, you know, fast forward, we're in the 70s. My mom does not have a lot of those resources. And financially, she's not stable. And so quickly remarried into a family. Within a 6-month window, she was remarried. And poof, I become one of six. And I'm living in a new place and I have all these new siblings and there's all these new rules. And this guy is really, really like militant. And, you know, he's just got this deep voice and he's not that loving daddy that I used to have. And so I just, as any kid, I think I just kind of like, and I just got real quiet and I went kind of back in the shadows, and that became my real safe place. You know, so I had one of my siblings who I could, you know, be a kid with. But anytime we were like in the adult area of the house, you know, I just, as small as I could be, the better. And then that's where that abuse started taking place amongst me and another. This is where the sexual abuse started. And I think because I was set in that position of, you know, quiet. And it was a perfect setting. I mean, I could keep a secret in that realm for the rest of my life. And so that went on. That went on for 3 years, three years. And, you know, again, my mom's surviving. You know, there's always a lot of questions about, well, how did your mom not see this? You know, I've done a lot of forgiving. I'm grateful for that. But, and so what happened is I've got all this stuff, my family life, my brother, I'm just stuffing all this stuff down. And, you know, we're in the Midwest. So drinking is just what we do. So then now I'm starting to like hang out with the wrong kids and I'm starting to drink. And what happens is in the 9th grade, I was sitting in a counselor's office. And of course I'm getting a little out of control at this stage. And the counselor had said, you know, Jules, I don't think we see much success for you here. Perhaps, you know, going the GED route might be the better way. And I was what, 14? You gave a 14-year-old the green light. And I was out the door before you could, I mean, blink an eye. I just went home and told my mom, this is what he said I'm going to do. I can do it. Because I finally could get away from the madness. Mm-hmm. And I finally had a sense of my own control. And so at 9th grade, and if you imagine, 14 years old, what are your life skills? Very limited.
Yes.
But then it's also disguised with the trauma that I've endured. And so I catapulted out just as one would expect. And I attracted the people that one would expect and did all the things that girls who are untreated with sexual abuse, the things that they do. I did. And so for 19 years.
19 years.
19 years. I tried to desperately, you know, my goal was to go out and party and be everything I can be. My goal was like, if I could just get my feet underneath me to support myself, I don't have to have a man around to take care of me or financially take care of me, which of course that came with a cost, right? There's a price for that. And that was my currency.
Yeah.
So it, you know, that's what all those years were doing, is like falling, making a mess, brushing myself off, starting again. You know, you see that saying, you know, if you're tired of starting over, then stop quitting. And that's really what this was. Like, I'm so tired of being tired.
Well, I read somewhere in your application, how many lives have you had? Because you've ended and then started and then ended like a cat with 9 lives, right? You kept on just kind of beginning again.
Because I became a chameleon, right? And that was one of the things that my trauma had taught me, is, you know, my mind and my heart don't need to match. I can be what you need me to be, right? And so you take that skill into the adult life, and now I can be a chameleon. And so the internet was my vehicle. And so just as many as we know get behind that keyboard, and I become who that person in that dating site wanted me to be. And then that is how, then I would go visit. And in, you know, my motive, even though I had other words coming out of my mouth, but my motive was, if I can have you connect with me strong enough that you're going to take me in so I can get my feet underneath me. I have 7 transcripts, because every time this would successfully happen, I would quickly get a job, get enrolled in college, you know, so it was like, that was my mission. And again, it was like this disease of alcoholism. It was always like, you know, a swing and miss. And in fact, here's where I really realized how out of control it was, is I went through my past taxes, because I was trying to put together this timeline. And within a 3-year window, I had moved 13 times. That's once every 12 weeks. And that's insane.
It was like the same pattern repeating, right? Because it was like, okay, that didn't work, but I'm going to try it again over here with the next person.
Yeah. And it's just that, it's that delusion, right? Like, okay, if I just tweak it just a little bit this much. And for me, it was like, if I could just keep my emotions to myself, of course, because I would outrage or lose control, because, you know, here I am, a crazy, you know, an alcoholic. You know, if I could just keep that side, just, you know, a secret, and they didn't have to see that. They just got to see that glamorous chameleon I could create. But yeah, to see the resilience, reading the book and seeing the resilience in this woman is just like mind blowing.
Well, it was almost like you were shrinking as a child, right? That 6-year-old that was being put into this new family. And then that's what you ended up having to do, because you're trying to fit a mold for these men to get yourself ahead and get on your own. But you actually had to shrink yourself and turn into something that's not, I mean, you probably didn't even know who you were.
No.
Because you could never be her.
No. And there was no need to go in and look for her, because she'd do me no good anyway, because she was a mess. So no, let's not even go there.
Like, and how did you break free of all of that? Because that's 19 years.
Yes.
Is there like an aha moment of, this is the last time I can do this? Was there a rock bottom or a rock bottomer?
I think of a rock skipping the water, how it kind of hits a couple times. Yeah. And that's how it is. You know, I think I hit that bottom, as we hear. I think there are 3 consecutive times that it just, I mean, we went down, you know, each time to really, you know, far depths in each one of those. And what it was, is I was in another relationship. I was in, you know, in Texas. I had, you know, done my whole pattern. And what had happened is I was out one day with some of the friends of this woman that I'm dating. And so we're in the back of the car. And of course, we've spent the weekend with them. So we're, you know, we're kind of like party buddies. And I just nonchalantly said, God, I wish I didn't drink so much. And without, I mean, like, it was like mind blowing. Like, I'm going through this tunnel, like things just happen so rapidly. And the girls in the front of that car, like their little ears just went up like antennas. One of them was in recovery for pills, and the other one was in Al-Anon. I had no idea. I kid you not, Lori. I was in a room of recovery in 30 minutes. 30 minutes. So here I'm sitting in this room. And of course, if you can just imagine, you're a hot mess. I'm a hot mess. And I walk into this smoky, stinky, burned coffee, like crotchety old people, this recovery room. And I'm just like mortified, right? I think an alcoholic is the only one who will be in the gutter and then look down at somebody else and be like, what, why are you such a drunk? You know, like look down upon them. That's totally what we do. And so here I am like, you know, like, oh, I sip martinis. It's not, no, sweetie, you just sit your hot ass down, you know, just the settle down. And there was like this moment in time where I just sat and I still feel that cold metal chair. And then I had these girls on both sides of me and they said, is anybody here for the first time? And I got the nudge. Put my hand up and they said, hey, you know, what's your name? I was like, it's Jules. They're like, welcome. Welcome. Now keep in mind, I have just been on a battlefield for 19 of these years. And I have somebody who said, welcome. And better yet, further on, they'll say, come back tomorrow. You're going to be here tomorrow. Hey, it's great to see you. Holy shit. It was life altering.
I'm getting chills. Yeah, I'm getting chills because that was not only did they see you, it's like in that space, you're not being judged. You can be yourself. And you couldn't do that before. You could never, you were always
my life depended on it.
Yeah.
Totally.
And so did you go back?
Absolutely. That was the best high I had gotten in years, right? Like just being around people and they gave up, you know, they write out their names and their telephone numbers and that envelope goes around to all the women and you know, they give you a little chip and a pamphlet. And I still have that envelope today. So like there's these golden moments in my life. And so we quickly, you know, of course I got back in the car. Those girls, of course, got on, figured out where I live, where's the nearest meeting. And I mean, boom. Like that's where I went that next day and I kept going and I never missed a meeting. I mean, I was working 12-hour shifts at a hospital. It didn't matter. I was 20 minutes late. I'd still go there for that hour meeting. I was determined, but I didn't even know I was alcoholic. I was determined to get my feet underneath me in this place. You call me what you want. I don't care. I can get my feet under here and you're going to listen to me and I'm not crazy. Right. And they're like, no girl, we completely get what you're thinking. Oh my God, finally.
Isn't that though what it is? Though it's really shifted AA or whatever type of meetings you might be talking about, where it really is, you're just trying to get yourself again, your feet back under you, whether it's sexual addiction, drug addiction, you know, mental health, alcohol addiction. Like I feel like the same thing with all of those scenarios is just finding yourself again, getting your feet properly placed back under you again.
Kind of like you're on a big ocean wave and you're being taken under and then you get a little gasp of air and you're like, okay, I got it. And then just to be, you know, whoosh, you know, your feet are up underneath you again. That's exactly how that feels. And you're just desperately looking, if I could just hang out for 3 minutes and catch my breath. I could do this. And that's what that room did for me. It gave me that space to let me catch my breath. And it wasn't pretty. I was very angry. And these people actually would listen. There's miracles that happen in those rooms. Nobody else would listen to me anymore at this point in time because I was too far. I was too traumatized and too full of defenses. And I was a warrior. It's rough out there. It's really rough out there.
Did you have any regressions from that? Or did you feel like once you got your feet kind of under you, you were able to slowly take steps forward? Or did you ever have any moments that there was, you know, a backpedaling or a slip up again?
Yeah, I'm fortunate. I think I'm also super thick-headed. I think that's part of it. That drive, you can imagine going through all of that. And then the 19 years, that constant drive and urgency, that didn't go anywhere when I got sober. And so I think that constant drive and urgency, that's what kept me just keep coming back. And so I'm fortunate. That was the first and the last sobriety date I've ever had. And that was March 27, 2007.
Oh, that's amazing. That's a long time ago now.
Yes.
And what happened after all of that? Because obviously that was your first step to slowly getting your feet under you and starting to heal and starting to find yourself.
God, yes.
Is that when the making of the woman kind of could start?
Nowhere near. Because I think, again, it's like, you know, the trauma is, you know, the door into alcohol and drug and all of that. And so it's like, I really just dug my feet into recovery for a long time, really long time. Got very active. I moved overseas to Switzerland and got involved in that, which is a whole different genre of recovery. And so I've had all of these like amazing spiritual experiences of things that I would have never been able to accomplish. Hell, I couldn't even get a roof over my head, let alone be jet set across the world, right? So, you know, it was like I was just finally basking in the light and helping other people. Oh my gosh. So really what happened is, you know, I'm growing, right? Again, this is a huge learning curve on this journey that I'm on. And so, you know, I've got a good chunk of sobriety underneath my belt. And I've decided that, you know, I just want to get into this corporate realm and really get financially stable, right? And so, you know, I go into a partnership and was able to, you know, successfully do that. And so, but here what happens is that now the outside looks really good, but the inside is still a little bit of a mess. And so that also is like where it's a really weird feeling. It's like you're sitting this feeling of inferiority, but it's not like just a small egotistical inferiority. It's the idea that these people have absolutely no idea of where I've come from. And the fact that you guys, you've had so much more education than I have. And you have these loving, supporting families. And, you know, I always was constantly separating myself. And so what happened then is I was able to go to various, you know, because I was financially in a position, I was able to go to, like, we have a place called The Meadows, and that is about, you know, kids in trauma. And as an adult, I was able to go and, you know, do a workshop at Hazelden. I'm sure you've heard of that. And, you know, like, so I was able to go, and that's really where the spiritual journey started, is because I'd done what I could do in the physical realm. And I could hold my emotions together, but really it was like that emotional spiritual spot, that little window is really where the healing needed to take place. That trust, that loving, that nurturing, that was all absent. And so being sober, I was allowed a clear slate. And so that's why my book is a lot about questioning the dogma. What is truth here? Authenticity. Or what is that? Is that somebody else's truth? Like, right? Like we were talking about being competitive women. Oh my God, is that like an oxymoron in some circles? Like, what do you mean? You know, you're supposed to be. So again, the cool thing is first, I didn't have the dogma because I wasn't in that social circle growing up. But in recovery now, what it is to be like, well, what do I want to do? I don't know how to swim, but I'd love to how to scuba dive. Okay, why can't I? You know, so it's like, I just really got like kind of like a kid-like perception on things. And I love a physique that is well, you know, just the drive that we have and the appreciation for that art. Why can't I do that? I'm 49 and I went to nationals. Don't tell me I can't.
And did you find, because I see this a lot in a lot of my clients, because I've helped many, many, many bodies get to stage. You control what's happening, right? And it is that drive and that dedication, kind of like the drive and dedication of going to that first meeting and being like, I'm going to be back tomorrow. And I'm going to be back the day after that and the day after that. And it is that propelling forward. And you need that same drive and dedication to constantly follow the nutrition plan, not miss the workouts, even when you're tired. Not give up, because there is really a select few that can actually do it and make it to a stage and not give up.
And see, there's one of the benefits, right? I wrote a blog about this. It's like stones to gems. So that used to be something that was seen as a negative in my life, that, oh my God, she's so driven. She's so independent. Well, let's flip that over here to this side of the spectrum. And that's exactly what made me succeed. Mm. That's what I love about doing this. And the book has been this beautiful example of seeing this little person and all her messiness and all, and to really recognize the strength, the miles she covered physically. And the fact that, you know, that this source or this God never allowed any harm. Mm-hmm. So I take all of that and I shift it into today. And they're now, they're attributes. I use them in my favor.
And so now, why anonymous? Because when I said Jules is an anonymous name, you like to keep your own name, or is there a story behind that?
So when I got sober, let me back up, in the Midwest, and I think it's kind of like that in most areas, we'll have nicknames. So like Richard will become Rick, or, you know, Thomas becomes Tom. Well, in the Midwest, it's Julie becomes Jules. Okay. So that I, you know, bits and pieces. But what happened was, is when I got sober, somebody said, when I introduced myself one time as Jules, I said, yes, because you're the diamond in the rough. And I was like, you know what? I've earned that. I have earned my name. I cherish my name. It is a constant reminder that, yes, I am a product of Source and I'm here to do good. So
it's almost not anonymous. It's just you stepped into Jules being you, your name. Mm-hmm. Like, that's you.
That's who I am. Mm-hmm. It happened really, again, when I got sober. Writing the book was challenging because now it's not just me, right? I'm married. I have high profile husband. And I was like, wait, I have to consider other people, like, completely mind blowing, right? So we had a lot of conversations like, what do we not? And let's face it, that book gets pretty raw. How much of this do we need to know? You know,
it's tough when you're writing a, because I just wrote my second and okay. I had to change a lot of names because it was well, if I got to change it for one, I got to change it for all now because it's getting too confusing. But when you're speaking of people and their stories or how they were in your story, it gets a little, you don't know what, whose feathers you're ruffling. You don't know because it's not just you and your emotions anymore.
Mm-mm. And it's your perception, which does not mean it was reality.
Oh, yes.
And that's something I had to really come to terms with. And also the judgment, like, oh my God. I mean, my mother-in-law read this book. Lori, she's just mortified, out of control. Like, she's like, have you read that thing? I mean, she verbally tells me how uncomfortable she was with it. But what I had to realize is that this is a story. I believe that Source gave me these parents, endure these things in order to do what I'm doing now. So really, this is not some story. It's just my facts line. This is how things happened. And when it comes to, you know, what if that uncle thought this or think that, you know what, to be very honest, I haven't even shared the book with them. I'm not here to bring in conflict. I am here to share my journey with other women who are struggling or misunderstanding or misguided. I could care less if their judgment is for or against me. That is never going to change this story. And so
don't read it, right? Is what I always say to my family members or people that are already judging me before they even read what I've put on those pieces of paper. You know, do me a favor then. Don't follow me on social media. Exactly. Don't buy the book, right? Because it is there to help others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It'd be like having somebody buy a biology book. Why are you picking that up? You know, you're an auto mechanic. Well, then why are you reading something you don't understand? Mm. Right. So yeah, I agree. It's interesting though. You know, you tell your friends about things all your life, but then when you put that stuff like pen to paper, man, like your ego gets up in there and your weepy little self gets up. I mean, it's just this, it's been a hell of an experience.
And what made you decide to write the book? You just said, you know what, I've lived this and I want to, if it reaches one person, I'm going to put it out there. And if it helps someone else, like those two women that helped you in the front seat of the car to take you to that meeting.
You know, I think I got to a stage, first off, anytime I would tell my story to anybody, I think I blew them out of the water to the point where they're like, girl, you need to write a damn book. Like, that's crazy. So I got that. And I got that from some of my college friends also. One of my dear friends who I reference in the front, it definitely was standing force behind that. But I think also what happens is when coming from the depths that darkness, all of that. It's like, I got that second chance, kind of like the giddiness I got when I got to go on stage again. And it's like, that second chance comes with almost like a responsibility, but it's not like a have to responsibility. It's like, I've got this wisdom. It's like saying, I got the cure for cancer. I don't think anybody in their right mind is going to be like, yeah, we're just going to talk about that tomorrow. No, I urgently want to get out there and share it with other people. Okay, maybe there's so many parts of it, but maybe you can relate to something of it, right? And so really we pretty much, and I'm a big meditator. I love chatting with Source. I'm a big energy girl. And so about a year before the book actually started, I started to get like some really strong meditations coming in and, you know, just really a lot of thoughts. And so I started just like, oh my God, how do I get this out there? Right. And so I would write, you know, I'm like, maybe I'll write a blog or maybe I'll write this document. I'll just, and that's what I did is every time something kind of bizarre would happen or I'd reference my past, I would go and I would write about it. And then everything, of course, lines up just divinely as it's supposed to. And in January, I met with Marlena. And that was an amazing experience to tell your story to another woman. Totally. And then to read it back. Unbelievable experience.
Well, that's amazing. Is that when the book came out?
No, she was done in, I think, around July, but then we did some marketing and then she launched in October.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yes. And she's definitely an entity of her own.
Like, right.
She totally is. Like, I just birthed her. I mean, that's like, it's like now I just got to make sure she gets into the right hands.
Oh, that's amazing. And so now you mentioned in your application when you wanted to come on the podcast, there's a few things as well about your lifestyle. And one of the things that you talk about is it ethical what you choose in terms of, and now is that relationships? Is that sexuality? But as soon as I saw the word ethical, I was like, I need to ask this, right? Because, you know, again, ethics are apples and oranges to some, what some people want to pass judgments on. I always say if it's not hurting me or anyone around me, everyone chooses to do what they want to do and what makes them happy. What did you mean by that?
You know, from my experience of getting sober and that clean slate that I got, I was able to then really go in and identify with things, right? I'm getting to know me. So one of the things I learned is that I was bisexual. And I also was very comfortable with it because it was at that authentic self. I no longer had that guilt or shame or, and keep in mind, I'm in Texas, I'm in the Bible Belt. So that outside input is very, very strong.
And had you been a straight female up until that point of finding out that you were bisexual?
I had situations happen before that, but to actually consider it, opposed to having an event, to actually considering it as part of my being. That's really when that came out. And so what happened is that because I think too, again, the stone and the gems, there's just something there. It's like, I think because I have had this experience, I now have the eyes for other things in a different light. So for instance, BDSM, most people from the outside, first off, most of the time when things are judged, it's because they just don't understand. That's really all. It's totally all. And so, but I had that sense of understanding because not necessarily that there was the physical part, but the psychological and that energy that takes place. And so as I was evolving and growing, I was able to be within that lifestyle in my personal life and then actually take it into a professional realm. And again, it was me providing a space for people who don't have it. And so, for example, as a femdom, I would attract or draw in male submissives. And 99% of them were married men to very typical households. There's the wife, there's the two kids, there's the house, there's the, you know, perfect. But something within them wasn't being satisfied. I can appreciate it. Totally. I've had to live in that, you know, chameleon skin for a while. And so then, you know, this, of course, once you're in that sort of circle, you meet all kinds of people. And if you meet them with an open heart, you really can learn a lot. And so then this actually set the stage for when I met my now husband. He was that person. He had the wife and the kids and there's a home and there's a job and da, 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 and he was separated. So when we sat down at the table and had coffee, he looked at me like, holy shit, does she really exist? Like, here is a woman who can tell you exactly not only what she wants, but what you're going to do for her. And he took it really well. And it wasn't that we necessarily went on into the BDSM scene with him, but that sexual exploration, you know, doing something more than just being a human, you know, learning about things about my body, you know, things that, you know, in which then brought me into the masculine and the feminine, you know, there's this whole new other area that I had never, you know, I've only cerebrally, in a sense, experienced life. And now energetically, I can experience life.
How did you step into that though? Because I feel like that six-year-old girl that was shrunk down and staying quiet and staying hidden, then the teenager or the 20-something that is just shaping yourself based on what everyone else needs around you and wants. Mm-hmm. How do you even get to a place where you can be like, you know, you're in charge, you're the, you know, I don't like the word dominatrix, yeah. but femdom, like yeah. you are taking the masculine and feminine. Is it because you had all of that strength in you? You just had been pushing it down that whole time?
You know, this is a really good question. I think that for me, there was a lot of empathy, first and foremost. I think that was one of it. I didn't realize even my power as a feminine woman, because I'd always, you know, had to live a different lifestyle, protective, very much in the masculine, you know, but the strength that we speak of is the feminine. So it's not necessarily that ideology that, oh, well, you got hurt by men then, and so now you're going to hurt men now. It's not that ideology. It is the idea that I can now, in that strength, I can provide for the masculine. I can, you know, so I don't think it, again, it has really nothing to do with the outside appearance, as with everything. So I think that was mostly what it was. And it was good. I was good at it. I mean, the connections were, I mean, I met some amazingly awesome people because they were so vulnerable. Do you know how beautiful people are when they're vulnerable, when they'll just cry, or they'll just tell you the biggest secret of their life? They leave like glowing.
Well, that's where I think too, it's almost a myth that it, like, thinking that's why that the domineering kind of aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I, and again, this is my opinion. I mean, we can all have those. It's almost like you're taking care of them in that space by giving them some things that they need, which nobody can judge what anyone else needs and what turns anyone else on. Like, we are all different beings. Mm-hmm. And I see it more as that caregiver role, even though, you know, your strength, you're in charge, you might be doing certain things. I just see it as you're taking care of their needs. You're giving them a safe space to come into where you're taking care of them.
And you know, what comes to mind as you're explaining that, it's kind of like, and I know this will just twist some people up, but it's like the nurturing mom who takes their kids to the really scary movie. So she makes sure they get there. She's taking care of them. You know, she's protecting them. The kids are going to go and they're going to have this overwhelming, amazing event of being scared and laughing and crying. And then they leave and they go back to their normal life. They go back, they get in the car and they go back and they go to school. That's the same thing. Right? Because a lot of times people misunderstand that because there's apparatuses and all this, like, that's just theatrics in a lot of ways. It's not, you know, it's the fear, just like when the scary movie was going down. It's part of the experience.
Well, and again, I think that unless we do it ourselves, and I've always been no judgments about anything. Again, if it's not hurting me, if it's not hurting people around me, unless they want to have a little bit of pain and they've asked for that, I don't bat an eyelash about anything. Nothing could shock me. Again, as long as it's in that space where that's what that person wants, they're doing it willingly. Mm-hmm. I love hearing about other experiences. It doesn't mean I'm going to go try it out tomorrow.
Totally.
But it means that you can come into my space. And I have friends where they'll tell me stories and I just take it all in. I'm like, tell me more. I need to know more. Whereas I find in society, if it's something scary on the outside of the box that we fit into, we don't want to let it in. We have our walls up. We're already judging it. we already have misconceptions, but we don't want to understand it. Mm-mm. And to me, that's, the world is such a big place with so many different things happening.
Yeah.
I like to understand what's going on. And then you're right. I don't see it. Like, as soon as you said it, I'm like, ah, sounds good. Like, it's like just another weekend. Like, it's not, it doesn't, that's what different people are into. And again, there's a lot of different fetishes out there. I mean, we could sit here and do 25 podcasts on a whole bunch of different ones, right? I think it's when we don't understand it. And then when we don't allow an understanding to happen where someone can actually explain it to us without judgments.
And you know, if you think about it, like alcoholism, even just coming out at that you're in recovery. I mean, look at that. Like even 10 years ago, that was a huge hush hush. You never tell people that. Or gay marriage. Oh my gosh. You know, so I think what it is more and more we're touched by people who we love. And that makes it, it's almost like, I'm not going to willingly learn this on my own, but I have to learn it because my brother's gay. I got to figure this out. I love him. Nothing can happen to him. You know? So I think that's what happens is then you actually get to experience it. So then it gives you an understanding like, oh, my brother's not a threat to me. And those two men holding hands. Well, I saw my brother holding hands with his boyfriend, you know? So I think that's part of it. And that's part of the reason why we use our voice. And also to show you, like, I'm not a weirdo. I don't, you know, I'm not the perception a lot of people see. In fact, I'm a very loving and caring person.
You see that too. I often will go to like the taboo, naughty but nice, you know, sex shows or different things where there it's at a big marketplace, a big arena. There's a whole bunch of different stuff going on there. Yeah. And I think when I've taken girlfriends with me, they're looking around and they're thinking, wow, that lady looks like my mom and that looks like my boss over there. And there's a whole bunch of different people that are there that you wouldn't have necessarily put in the box of even wanting to be there. And it's like, not everybody's wearing tattoos and leather here. Like it is a wide variety of people just exploring different things that are out there.
Exactly. Watching different movies.
Yes. And now, so what would someone like your mother-in-law think about that? Because remember, she was like, oh, the book, right?
Oh, yeah. The same response. that was the same response. And I think because of that part of the chapter or that part of the book, those chapters, I think were very mortifying for her. And I have to be honest, I probably would not have. I did not promote the book to her at all. Because I knew she was going to be one of those people who was not, you know, she's just not going to stand for it. And so actually, I didn't suggest it. I didn't give her one. In fact, she had to actually ask for one. And I was like, all right, well, no, just no. So I've become very mindful of that. Just because I'm excited about something doesn't mean that everybody else wants to, you know, wants to read all of that, even though my intention is good. I have no means, but...
Because it reached somebody. My book, anytime I say, like someone will say, was it a bestseller? And I'll say, yeah, but when I wrote it, it was if it helps one person. Mm-hmm. And that's every chapter. I mean, one chapter might hit one person and resonate with them, another one. And then there's always going to be the naysayers that are, it just doesn't work for them. And that's okay. The world is a big place. So there's a lot of other books they can buy.
Another thing that I also thought of, someone told me, well, now you're immortal. And I was like, what do you mean? She goes, your story will live forever. So it might not even be in my lifetime, Lori, that this happens or any, you know, I've already, you know, gotten feedback, but it's like, this could be one of those books that I know I've had books on my shelves that I'll be like, oh, look at that one. And you look and you read it again and you're like, holy shit, I didn't know, was that in there last time? You know, this could be one of those books.
It could be made into a movie 20 years from now, 30 years from now.
Exactly.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. And so now where are you in your space now? So having written the book, are you still doing the same thing you were doing before in terms of some of the femdom stuff?
No, actually, I have not done any of that now. And not necessarily for any reason, but my husband and I, we sail on sailboats. And so, and we like, you know, I do scuba diving. And so a lot of the stuff I do now is just different activities, simply as simple as I'm going to go watch a different movie. I'm going to go do another hobby. There was actually a time because the book has come out and of course you want to promote it. And, you know, there was a phase in time where they're like, oh my God, Jules, if you could just, you know, let's do it like the university, you know, Jules, Mr. University or something. And, you know, and it's like, ah, and I tried to go back into the shoes and I was just like, ah, these shoes don't fit. They don't fit anymore. And so then that was the realization that just because I'm good at something doesn't mean that I have to do it. So in a sense, my own dogma, like I had to question my own dogma, like, oh, well, you're good at that. You better keep doing that. No. So that's, so what it's done now is, you know, we've done this huge launch, you know, we've done all this marketing and thank God for the holidays. Cause now we're like, let's let the dust settle. But you know, it's something super cool that came up because I was struggling with the stepmom or the, you know, the mother-in-laws in the world. I was really like, God, you know, because you, people aren't always so open-minded, be like, okay, well, I'll just flip past this chapter. You know, and so I'm like, how can I reach more? And just last week, Marlena wrote me and said, have you seen, and she gave me an example, and it's about a memoir that was written. And then he wrote the clean version. Okay, girl, remember ninth grade, I do not have this sort of experience and how books are published and all of this. And so I was like, brilliance. So now what we're going to do is I'm going to, you know, do a clean version and maybe help people understand maybe without so much detail. And of course, the audio. Oh my gosh, people are like, your voice, girl, you got to have that. You got to be reading your book. So I've been in my closet doing that.
I just did. You have to do it. Actually, while I was talking to you, I just released mine and my voice, and it's my little tiny stories. And even some of my friends that were on really long driving stints, yeah, they're like, it was like you were in the car with me for like, yes, 9 hours.
And oh, cool.
Laughing, yes, during some of it, crying during some of it. But I've heard the idea of the clean version as well, because my stories could reach more like preteen teen girls.
Mm-hmm. That's where it happens, right?
Well, it does. And when I went to write my second book, my publisher said, you know, can you tone down the swearing a little? Let's make it super clean. And then it can maybe reach that. Well, I mean, I don't tone down. I think I swore more because I was supposed to not, right? So it ended up afterwards, I said, well, I can do a clean version later for them. I can rewrite it for that audience.
Yep.
But I love that you said that because you still have things you want to reach people. And if
I do,
I mean, sometimes it's not their views, it's how they've been brought up.
Totally. Yeah.
And it's hard to reprogram them at, you know, my mom in her 60s, 70s, she's not reprogramming at this point. But could benefit from certain parts of the book, right? Mm-hmm. So that's that's an amazing idea.
And I just could not wrap my brain around going small. Mm. Going back into that small space because of the adults around me not comfortable. That was not a place for me. I can't go back there, girl. So it's like, okay, I can't cut that out. And I can't, let's just, you know, because I was just going to like cut the whole thing out and then just republish it. And I was like, no, because let's face it, girls today, teenage girls today are doing worse things sexually or more explorative than I was condoned for. So, you know, it's like, so, you know, for us or for people in my generation, it's like, oh, you said what? You know, but then, you know, now here it's like, well, anal is, I'm not losing my virginity, you know? So it's like, I mean, a totally different generation. Thank God we evolve. But so yeah, it's not going to offend them. It's going to offend my generation.
Well, and the same thing, I had the same experience with my books, both of them, but also on social media in the last year, I did a lot of photo shoots where I was in lingerie or nothing. And there was a lot of things that were posted. And I had a lot of backlash from family members that just wasn't their thing. It wasn't something I had ever done before. So they were very taken aback by it. And part of my reasoning for doing it was to empower women to feel better in their skin at no matter what age, because I turned 45. Yes. I wanted to say I'm my best self. Mm-hmm. And for me to delete all of it and take steps back because their feelings were hurt.
Oh, yeah.
And my favorite comment from a family member was, I have a 19-year-old daughter and a 15-year-old son. And I and they said, well, what, they must just be appalled. And I said, no, they had their mama blocked a long time ago. They don't want me to see what they're posting. So, I mean, for them, it's like, ah, yeah. Oh, my mom's in her underwear on the internet again. It is not anything that phases them because I've brought them up to not judge other people for that.
And the shame isn't there.
It's not. And just the other day, my son, who's 15, was here with a bunch of girls from his drama program in high school. And they all follow me on social media. And he was like, mom, they said that this about your book. And they were asking about that. Mm. He was proud of what I was doing because it was empowering them.
Oh, yes.
So had I backed down.
Right.
And deleted it all or censored myself because of worry and judgments. Mm. So it comes back. But I like what you said about having to step into the shoes again of going back and putting the gear back on and going back to what you were good at. Mm-hmm. You evolved and you're here now. So it's not that you don't like that old version of yourself. It's like what you asked me before we hit record. When I stopped competing, I couldn't go back there again because people would always say, well, never say never. No, I'm a different person now. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that I don't love that part of my life and have great admiration for it and help others step into it. Mm-hmm. I'm in this space now and I don't need to.
Yeah.
And that's what I got when you said that. I was like, you're a different woman now. You're a different person now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for me, it's like, and I have to say that if there wasn't such a stigma to it, I would not have acquired so much shame. And also I wouldn't feel like I have to keep it a secret. And those are things that I won't play with today. Mm-hmm. Are any of those emotions. So it's not that I'm necessarily uncomfortable, you know, and that's why I don't do it. It was just like, if I didn't get such, I don't want to go into secrecy, but just because the way the world's set up is like, I don't want to have to go in secrecy. And I just, no. So
funny, even fitness competitions. I mean, I did them when no one else did them. Right. It was like, I was the odd girl in the gym, that one alien being that. And I remember it being a problem for my older relatives of just being in a bikini on stage. And that was like porn to them, right? Like it was like, oh, you guys, or that when you Google my name, most of the images that come up are me in a bikini on stage. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of female clients that are moms and they take a lot of backlash from husbands or workspaces or relatives. And it's like, it really is pushing us down, right? And that we got to hide ourselves, especially something we're so proud of doing.
And it's us. It's our being. You know, I think as well, like my husband will be like, okay, you know, I kind of like you this way. Cause I'm like, oh my gosh, things are not as hard as they used to be. I think I'm losing my shoulders. And he's like, you're not losing your shoulders. You know, he's like, I kind of like you a little softer. And I adore my husband. I adore him. I'm so fucking grateful for the patience this man has had. But the idea that somebody is going to dictate my body, that doesn't sit well with me. That's not an option. And it's not out of hatred or deceit. It's really for self-love. I'm going to do me, you know? And so I find that with anything, I look at my motive and if my heart is in it, that's really what matters the most. So,
And your shoulders, we can see it on the YouTube for the podcast. I'm like, I still have shoulders, but I'm like, I gotta go hit the shoulders. I just did shoulders today, but your shoulders are looking pretty darn good over there.
So yeah, I told you I haven't worked out in 5 weeks. Today is going to be the first day. And girl, you know what I'm going to hit? Either legs or shoulders.
My favorite, shoulders. Yes. And so now what's next for you? Because you talked about doing the audiobook.
Yes.
You're going to have another competition coming up, I'm sure.
Yes, yes. There's going to be an empty spot in that first place. Did you know that? So I thought, you know, I better at least show up.
Which show was it? Was it the NPC Nationals you did?
North America's.
Oh, North Americans. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a big one. That's a big one. In fact, I have to tell you, you'll appreciate this. You know, they're doing like in seventh place and in sixth place and fifth place and fourth place. And that moment when they said fourth place, the thought that shot through my head is, fuck, I'm on the wrong stage. I don't suppose I'm, this is not my class. This is not my class. I'm not going to. And for third place is, oh my God, I just placed in the top three. I mean, it was like this boomerang of thoughts. But yeah, that I think, you know, what comes next, it's already happening. You know, what we're doing right here is what's coming next. You know, we're talking, we're communicating, we're, you know, taken out of this isolation and relating and, you know, and I think what is happening is that, you know, I'm continue to be guided through meditations and through my gods and skins, you know, who I connect with. And that's how I navigate. And so, you know, I'm open to doing, you know, guest speaking. You know, I really want to find that pivotal spot, like you were talking about, that preteen. You know, that's really where a lot of decision making of who you are really takes place. And I think if we got into that space and taught how to guide intuitively, there could be no harm. So in other words, my rash story would not be harmful, in other words. So that's kind of what's happening. And I get to do these amazing podcasts and talk with people and connect with people all around the world, which is absolutely fantastic. I could always have another friend, you know, and then I get to, oh my gosh, you know how it is. When girls write to you and they say, oh my God, I had one lady say, if I would have read your book before Wednesday, I would not be on my way to this treatment center and attempted suicide. Girl, who makes those? How does that kind of stuff happen? Do you know what I mean? It's like, I have a cure for cancer. I have a responsibility and urgency to get it out to other people and quick.
You've been given this gift, right?
Totally.
It doesn't matter if somebody doesn't see it as a gift around you, that's on them. That's their judgments. And you just keep putting the word out there and reaching as many people, because you might catch that person that didn't go to that treatment center just in time. Right. And that's why you do. And I like what you said about you're not really planning what's next, because it's like you're riding a good wave. A wave that you know isn't going to crash. It just might take little stops here and there. And it's going to take you where you're supposed to go.
Totally. Like, I belong in the passenger seat. I always say, like, my God is over there in the driver's seat, you know, and I get over there and I hop on, like, I got this, you know, like, it's a big truck. I know where we're going. And God's like, Jules, you need to be over there and you need to sit down in your seat, the co-pilot seat. I will drive.
Right.
You just keep pedaling. You just keep going. I'm going to drive.
See, for me, it's like, are we there yet? is this our stop? Are we there yet? Like, that's because the planner in me is always like, Lori's just riding with the wave, whatever comes next. But then I got my list and I'm like, do we know when that's coming next and who might be involved in the next?
Yeah. But do you ever find that your list takes you way off path?
Always. Again, I mean, I went from writing about fitness and all about wellness to I was in my tutu jumping around on the bed with Cheerios and talking about rock bottom and fairy tales. And I mean, life just takes us. But I think it's when we sit back and just let us, like, it just take me. I trust you, universe. I trust you, God, whatever you might believe in. I think as we get older, that's where I say, I'm going to be okay. Whatever comes my way, I can handle it.
Yeah. And I think that's wisdom. I think wisdom for me is a bunch of experiences. You know, it's kind of like the graduate degree of life. You know, I've got 15 or 20 years worth of, you know, teaching that or doing that. I have bigger insight than some folks, right? So, but yeah, I love as we even talk, you and I now, I mean, we're nowhere near in the vicinity of each other, yet the energy between us and the excitement and the connection. I mean, this is what the world needs more of, and whatever color that may be and whatever area of the world that needs to be, just that, hey, you know what, girl, are you okay? And you do you. I'm right here. I'm going to hold you. I gotcha. Right.
Well, and I can't wait till because we do it on Zoom and I can feel it. I mean, I always feel energy around me. And for some reason, I believe we're all magnetic. I think we found each other just on a whim, right? It's mm-hmm. like, you're in Dallas, I'm way up here. We do connect. And I feel like as the world is opening more up and we can have more big events and we can actually mm-hmm. hug each other and be in each yes. other's space, that's where we're going. I can see it. I can Got feel it. I'm keeping that vision because I think we all need more of that.
Yes. And maybe this is the stone of that, right? So then when we do get to the gem of it, when I do get to be in the same room with you, that hug is going to be amazing. You know, maybe that's it. Yeah.
I see it. I feel it. I can't wait. I can't wait for it. I can't wait for it.
Yes.
What would be like your mic drop truth bomb for the listeners? It's always hard to sum it up because you've lived a very long life and you're still continuing to live a very full life surrounding kind of being that chameleon, shrinking down, finding your way. What would you say to someone that maybe is sitting in the back seat of the car and you're mm-hmm. one of those two girls in the front?
The turning point for me was when somebody told me, you're exactly where you're supposed to be, doing exactly what you're doing. Nothing's wrong. You're not wrong. It's not wrong. It's all in divine timing. Because I pushed and tried and fell and got back up, and that I was supposed to fall 15 times. You're exactly where you're supposed to be. To see that big picture gives me a lot of, whew, you know what I'm saying? There's a lot of love in that statement and a lot of peace in a sense. Like, yeah, this is going to be rocky. This is going to be a rocky ass road, but I'm right here by you. So yeah, it's exactly how it's supposed to be.
I love that. I'm going to close on that note because that was so awesome. Thank you so much for being here.
Girl, Lori, thank you. I am so grateful we got to do this. Perfect way to start my week.
I am too. And I always finish my podcast like I finish each chapter of my book. And I say, rescue your own damn self in stepping into you unapologetically, knowing that you are exactly where you are supposed to be. And if it gets rocky, because it's going to, you can mm-hmm. handle it. And definitely just make sure, because I feel like I've got goosebumps, surround yourself with more people like Jules,
right,
like me, that have that no judgment zone so mm-hmm. that you can live sassily ever after. And Jules, I can't wait. We're going to meet one day. I can't wait to give you a big hug. Thank you for sharing your story and continuing yes. to share it.
Absolutely. Definitely. Thank you.
And we'll do this again soon. We'll be talking about the next thing that's happened. I know there's going to be something else for sure.
I promise. Let's do it.
Thanks so much for listening, friends. For more sassy and magical adventures, be sure to check out my website, lorimork.com. Or follow me on Instagram at lori.mork. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast where each and every week we release a new episode featuring queens, kings, divas, vixens, gods and goddesses, and just some totally awesome guests who are ruling their kingdom and narrating their own feisty fairy tales. It's time to rescue your own damn self and live sassily ever after.